When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Forget the frustration of picking commerce platforms when you switch your business to Shopify, the global commerce platform that supercharges your selling wherever you sell. With Shopify, you'll harness the same intuitive features, trusted apps, and powerful analytics used by the world's leading brands. Sign up today for your $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/tech, all lowercase. That's shopify.com/tech.
Hello, everyone. Welcome back to the Underrated Movie Podcast. This is a podcast where we discuss films that are underrated, underappreciated, and ones that have slipped under the radar and passed most people by. And once a year, an underrated movie that is so bad that it's good. So for this tradition, you know, I've been keeping it going for a few years now. I wanted to talk about another movie that I thought was just kind of a messy masterpiece, a movie that was good for all the wrong reasons. And I wanted to bring on one of the people who knows the most about movies and the most about schlocky movies, and that is my good buddy Matt from the Matt and Mark Movie Show. Matt, how's it going?
Hello, Derek. Happy April Fool's Day. Thank you for having me. I'm always happy to talk schlock. Basically, for me, 365 days a year is April Fool's Day on my show. I want to speak only of bad.
Well, yeah, I'm glad I called the right guy then. Before we dive into it, like I mentioned, you're a master of schlock, but you do have your film credentials. What do you want to tell the people about the Matt and Mark Movie Show?
Oh, yeah, we're the Matt and Mark Movie Show. I like to tell people now that we have somewhat serious conversations about very unserious movies. Our tastes are very eclectic. We like cult, horror, genre, action, 80s, 90s. Basically, if it comes with a big old bucket of cheese on our celluloid, that's how we prefer things on my show. We review new releases, but really, in light of the strikes and how light everything's been this past quarter, really, at the Cineplex, we've kind of just been doing a line of retro reviews, which has been really fun. You know, we're going back, checking out older horror movies from the 90s, much to my co-host's chagrin. But it's a really fun show, very light. And we welcome all new people, obviously. It's a little like Scientology. We want to lure you in. We're trying to lure you in.
Yeah, and much like Scientology and this movie, it's all about conspiracy theories, right?
That's right. I was going to say, the minute I started rewatching this, I was like, is this Alex Jones's favorite movie? Because it might be.
It very well could be. And, you know, that brings me to, yeah, I'll just introduce the movie, which is, of course, directed by Roland Emmerich, who is a name that fans of disaster movies of the 90s and the early aughts, when those movies dominated the box office, might know. He's somebody who, other than disaster movies, which, of course, this is also a fan of conspiracy theory movies, which, of course, this also checks off. He got both. He combined his Independence Day with his Anonymous creds. So, you know, you get the best of both worlds with that. This one, though, I think that it maybe had been a little past due. The you're not going to be able to release something and have it do Independence Day numbers in the year 2022, as we saw with Independence Day 2. But Matt, what's your history with this movie, and I guess Roland Emmerich in general? Did you see this one in theaters?
I did. I try to see just about every schlocky piece of crap in theaters. I will say I love Roland Emmerich. I don't say that ironically. I say that with genuine sincerity. I have been obviously a big fan since the first time I sat down in a theater and I saw Stargate, which was my first exposure to him. I saw it in the theater and I thought it was like the coolest movie I saw that summer. And then again, he hit us 2 years later with Independence Day. And I was like, is this guy the best movie maker alive? And of course, as his career progressed and I got older, and I was like, you know, sort of went into film school, I was like, I'm sort of seeing some cracks in the armor here. I love it. I'm also a big fan of disaster movies, so do keep that in mind, listener. I do tend to grade them on a curve simply because I do love disaster movies. It's a favorite subgenre of mine. I also love that basically when you're talking about disaster movies, Roland Emmerich has kind of become and is still kind of holds the crown as like the man. He's the master of disaster, or the disaster piece maker, if you will. I think it's weird that with Moonfall specifically, he's kind of covered his greatest hits like a lot. You know, like I feel like in some degree, The Day After Tomorrow kind of covers familiar territory from Independence Day, and then 2012 kind of covers both of those, and then Moonfall feels like it covers almost everything in his filmography. So he is a little like, I don't want to say Rolling Stonesy, but like you know what you're getting. If you buy the ticket, he's going to play the same five songs. That's kind of what you're paying for. So I respect that. But yeah, I saw this in the theater. I wasn't expecting greatness. I will say I loved 2012. I think 2012 is like the best of his like new school cover movies. You can't beat Independence Day. It's a stone cold classic. But yeah, Moonfall is an oddity. I'm happy it exists, but boy, oh boy, do I have a lot of complaints about it.
Yeah. And you know, for me, I'm like, I think a couple years behind you, you know, when you were in film school, you know, learning about what good cinema was, I was like, wow, The Day After Tomorrow is the best fucking thing I've ever seen. Oh my God, Jake Gyllenhaal running from the wolves in the ice. This is awesome. And then, you know, obviously as time went by and the market changed, this was one that it was one of the most independent films of all time. Emmerich didn't have the financial backing that he did previously with those earlier movies. And we saw the box office slowly but surely decline on those movies. I actually did make a point to try and see this one in theaters. I think I was one of the few. Were you among them as well?
I absolutely was. Yeah, I was there opening weekend simply by virtue of the fact that I was like, hey, I think if you're going to see a Roland Emmerich movie, the best first exposure to it is on the biggest screen possible with a fantastic sound system, because at least you will get to see a lot of big destruction. You want to see that 50 feet tall. You don't want to see that on like a 40-inch TV at home.
Yeah, definitely. And, you know, people always kind of throw out the so bad it's good thing. And it's something that I like to reserve to do once a year for April Fool's Day. It always feels appropriate. And they're never movies that I hate. They're always the, you know, I'll call them like the one-star heart letterbox reviews, because it's ones that I'm like, you get a one-star for quality, but you get a heart because I do love it and I appreciate it. Because clearly, everybody involved in this movie really cared about it. They weren't just phoning it in like Madam Web or something, you know? They really gave a shit. They really thought they were, maybe not Patrick Wilson, I don't know. But like, clearly, Roland Emmerich thought he was making some kind of masterpiece. And I think that to be a real so bad it's good movie, you gotta really believe your own bullshit a little bit, you know?
I definitely think, yeah, you have to get high off your own supply. You have to love what you're doing. And he definitely does. I kind of look at Roland Emmerich at this stage in his career. He's like Rocky in Rocky VI. He's tasted greatness, but it's been a long time. He lives in a shitty trailer now. And every sort of exhibition match that we, the audience, know is not a title fight, to him, it's the biggest fight in the world. So I'm pretty sure, to stretch this metaphor even further, I think in Roland Emmerich's brain, he thought this was maybe going to be his chance at a comeback. Maybe an Independence Day-like hit for him, right? Rocky returning to his heavyweight roots. And modern audiences were not ready for Roland Emmerich's vision of Alec Jones's wet dream. He's not ready.
Yeah, this movie, It really is something else. It's really, because yeah, I think maybe 5, 10 years earlier, it might have been a hit. I don't know. Because it does, feel, like you said, very much like the greatest hits of Emmerich's career. But it also does feel like, ironically enough, because this movie is all about AI and AI being good or evil or whatever, it does feel kind of like a movie that is written by AI. Like, it's like, what is the son's name? Sonny. Like, it's just like all, hitting all of the tropes. It's just like we put all of Roland Emmerich's past movies into a machine, and this is what, like, if you told me that's how this movie came about, it's like the moon creeps up behind them. It's like, what? Okay. It kind of is ridiculous. It's almost like a joke, but that's what makes it such a, like, it's like a perfect midnight movie. When I saw this in the theater, friend and I went, we had a couple drinks and we had a blast watching it, and it has this stuff like, you're like, this was around the time when it's like, well, we've got to release this movie in China. It's an independent film that has Chinese backers, so randomly insert Chinese character into this and they will say a couple lines in Chinese, and they have to have the line of like, oh, the space shuttle is here, we have some money from the Chinese space program. It has nothing to do with anything. They just had to put it in because they were like, we've got those Chinese dollars, so we need to make sure this plays in China. It was the thing that was very prevalent at the time.
Oh yeah, we have to please our Chinese corporate overlords. We have to pay respect. They wrote a giant check. And you know what? I respect them for that. I'm kind of glad Hollywood's getting out of this because it's kind of a dirty little secret that we got a lot of Chinese money in our bigger Hollywood productions of the last 10 years. And there are some contingencies that come with that money. We get some actors, sometimes get a great actor. Other times you get an actor that, maybe English is a second language, and that does unfortunately impact the performance. But it's hard because, like you said, there are sensibilities. I think that I don't want to get into a whole global cinema conversation. I just think the sensibilities of the Chinese audience and the American audiences are obviously different. And when we try to smash that together into a blockbuster, those two flavors don't mix all the time. They work sometimes. Yeah, but here it feels like very weird and obvious. Like, here is producer's niece. She's in the movie. We're going to give her a lot of business. She gets a love story. She gets a giant moment. Yeah. I want to say really quick, too, on the so bad it's good tip. I loved your take on the AIs writing like 10,000 different scripts. To me, I totally felt that, but I felt it in less the disaster way and more in the way that like general character scenes work. So, like, you and I watch a lot of movies, we understand how two characters interact in a scene. This is like an AI of a copy of a copy of a soap opera of a copy, because, like you said, just like the kid's name is Sonny, like, there's something so canned. You can predict what a character is going to say before they say it. That's what kind of movie this is. So, if two characters are interacting, if a mom meets her kid, the first thing they're going to do is like be like, I told you the last time that your dad is trying hard to win his life back, and you need to be a part of that. Like, it's very soap opera-y. The stakes are ridiculous. Like, the human stakes are ridiculous. Of course, the moon shit is crazy, but the human stakes feel so canned and false that it's kind of amazing, because you really can play a game where you guess the dialogue and you will be right.
Yeah, and like, a good example of that, I feel like, is the Michael Peña character, who feels like, very much like the new husband to the divorced ex-wife of the main character, and he's just here to, have this conflict with the son, and then he's like, I always thought of you as a son, and you're like, well, this motherfucker is dead, like, in the next scene, you're like, I know
Dude,
exactly what's gonna happen with that.
that's a lot of unfortunate business too, because in the middle of, I think, the best sequence of this movie, it unfortunately turns into a Lexus commercial. We can't
Oh
gloss
my
over
God,
that.
yes.
Like, not only is Michael Pena's character a car dealer, he works at a Lexus dealership while they're in the middle of a crazy car chase that is probably my favorite scene in this entire movie. It basically devolves into a glorified in-movie Lexus ad where it becomes a commercial. The characters are commenting on the quality of the car. Switch it into sport mode. They're like advertising all the features the new Lexus has. I somehow like breezed past that on my initial viewing. When I watched this yesterday for the show, I was like, what the fuck is happening right now? Are we stopping the action to have a Lexus ad? I was like, what the fucking balls on Emmerich? Why? I know why, but why? It's rhetorical.
No, and I think, because that is something I definitely noted when I first saw it, and then I took a note of it rewatching it this time, because there's that moment when, yeah, they are having that car chase, and the whole time, I guess they have it in like eco mode or whatever, and then Peña just goes, switch it into overdrive, maximum overdrive, and then it's a close-up of the dial, and you see him turn it to sport, and then it starts going faster, and I was like, that is the most insane product placement I've ever seen in a movie, and it feels perfectly at home with this insane fucking movie. Once again, it feels like an AI's example of product placement.
Yes, and also too, that the Lexus ad, the dumb way people interact, and like, okay, so it's a movie about the moon crashing into Earth. Okay, cool idea, ridiculous, but it's Roland Emmerich, okay? So of course, AI would see that concept and go, well, we need to have some social unrest. So on the side of the fucking shuttle, everybody is fleeing. Life as we know it has been turned upside down. People are dying, breakdown of society. Someone took the time to tag and spray paint the side of the shuttle, fuck the moon. Because that's what an AI thinks human beings would do. That's what I'm saying. I had to laugh. I forgot about so much dumb stuff in this movie. We can run it down, but like the fuck the moon thing on the side of the shuttle was amazing and stupid. Or stupidly amazing, rather. The Lexus ad was stupidly amazing. The fact that the guy from Game of Thrones, I'm sorry, I forgot his name. That guy is British. Simple thing. His mom, no British accent. She's American. There's no explanation for it, but that's the level. That's the level. This is the kind of movie where it's like, well, maybe his mom's American and there's a rich backstory. No, it's just that they were like, I don't give a shit. She doesn't have a British accent and he's British. Who gives a shit? Moonfall.
Yeah. Yeah. And then, like, you know, just to put that. So, you know, something else that I noticed, like, why would his mom always tell him, don't ask for permission, ask for forgiveness? Like, why would she, like, he repeats it multiple times. She always tells him, I'm like, if you're fucking around as a kid, your mom would absolutely never say that to you. And there's so many, like, weird things like that in the movie. Like, my favorite one is that they're like, well, we need a way to explain, get this expository dialogue out. Well, how about we roll Donald Sutherland out in a wheelchair? He's going to tell Halle Berry the whole conspiracy, and then he's going to roll away and shoot himself in the face. It's insane.
Yes. Okay. All right. Thank you for bringing up Donald Sutherland. So this movie misses a lot of opportunities, but the Donald Sutherland is the worst one because, as you know, his claim to fame, the thing he's known for in the horror and sci-fi community, is Invasion of the Body Snatchers. His famous scene where he goes, right? Everybody's seen it. It's been memed. It's on t-shirts. How do you cast that guy and not have him be an alien of some kind? Or an AI projection of some kind. I kept waiting for when the movie really goes full tilt sci-fi, for like when the AI's projecting. I kept waiting for him to come back because I was like, that feels like classic Emmerich to make that connection for the audience. That bit of stunt casting, bring him in. That is absolutely not what happens to the 2022 Emmerich of today. He has no time for that. He's like, nope, we got Donald Sutherland for the day. And that's all we could afford. That's what we can get with this money. That's it.
Mm-hmm. And speaking of like weird character stuff, the other one that I noted, tell me what you thought about this, because it was very weird to me both times I watched it, is the whole dynamic of Halle Berry and Patrick Wilson, because it feels the entire time like they're clearly setting these people up to be together at the end. Like, because it starts with like, oh, you guys fight like an old married couple, or and then she's my work wife, blah, 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 blah. And they're both newly married or whatever. And then they, you know, cuts to years later, they both have gone through their own divorces. And then they have like a bunch of strife. And over the course of the movie, they come back together. There's a lot of flirtation. Even the last scene between them, they're like, we make a really good couple. Yeah, we do. And you're like, oh, this is the moment. And then it just doesn't happen. They're just like, we're a great team. Anyway, the end of the movie is now. Like, it felt, I was like, did something get cut? What? Like, AI, what's your take on that?
Did the AI hiccup? Because it missed the golden opportunity for that scene at the end. If they actually did get together to kiss and say, I love you to the moon and back. Come on, AI. It was right there. Yes, I agree 100% with you. It is set up and played exactly like that. And I don't think it's some like clever subversion of expectation. Like, ooh, the audience will go on a trip with us and think that that's what's going to happen. And then we're going to flip it on them. no one that made this movie is that smart. It's just a weird misguided choice, like every other choice in this movie. Can we talk about the fact that, okay, I'm glad you brought up Halle Berry and I'm glad you brought up Patrick Wilson, right? This is two big stars. Poor Patrick Wilson needs a better agent because he keeps getting bad movies.
Yes.
And he's a great guy and a great actor, but God, he has just been like in one meatball after another. I have to say, this movie doesn't wake up for about 45 minutes. The first 45 minutes is everything Derek just said. It's like, it's a lot of establishing pieces. I think it thinks it's a different kind of movie than it actually is. It's like Halle Berry and Patrick Wilson fighting. Oh, the stuff happens where he's kind of been ashamed. He's been disgraced at his job. We have to fill the audience in that his shit at home sucks. She's now the head of NASA. We're doing all this table setting. And you're like, whoa, is this a Roland Emmerich movie? What's going on? Things haven't blown up yet. And then it's almost like the movie goes in a big rush to kind of give you the broad strokes of what it thinks a Roland Emmerich movie is. Okay, we got to see a tidal wave. You know, it can't just be one or two boats. Apparently, everybody's yacht was docked that day because there's like 89 yachts that roll through town. Okay, all right, fun. Those are rolling in. Waves are crashing. There's a flood, right? I actually, and as much as I waited for that big disaster piece stuff, because I was not interested in anything that was happening with the actors, you know, because there were so many dumb choices, like, again, AI, like Patrick Wilson's character is broke and can't afford rent because he's supposed to be an underdog, I guess, that makes you root for him. Yet he still has his like super fancy antique motorcycle, super fancy sport car, things he could sell or collateral to pay his rent, pay his bills. Anyway, that's the kind of movie this is. I wasn't interested in any of that work. I was interested in getting to the disaster stuff. The disaster stuff was so forced and rushed. I actually didn't like the movie until it went full tilt weird, like where it was like, okay, well, what would happen if the moon truly did begin to fall out of orbit? It would begin to fuck with the gravity. It would begin to fuck with the weather. Our sense of time is going to be different. We're going to have all this crazy time displacement, these weird events. I love the like little touches of like, oh no, the moon's coming again, coming around faster. Everybody's fleeing the NASA site. And the two NASA guys have to run to the chopper to get out. And they're bounding like Superman. Yeah. They're like bounding, like even though they're on, there's no gravity. They're just fucking bounding. It looks great. And it's such a silly detail. But like, I think that full tilt sci-fi stuff is when the movie sort of gets it right. Same deal with the car chase, which is like my favorite bit in the movie. Same deal when she's got to, lift the tree off the guy. Like, of course, like, let's have fun with that stuff. Get into the weirdness of the idea that the moon is a mega structure. That was like something, again, I don't listen to Alex Jones, so that was something that like was completely foreign to me. I've never heard that before. I'd never heard of megastructuralism or anything like that. Mm-hmm. It just felt like a great sci-fi, zany sci-fi problem in a movie. But yeah, man, I think the first 45 minutes are rough, rough, rough stuff. Mm-hmm. But at least once you go full tilt sci-fi, it kind of starts to make up for it a little bit.
Yeah, I totally agree, because this movie is just so weird that it's like, how can you not enjoy it? And also, like, they clearly spent a lot of money on this movie, and it's all up there on the screen. They are trying things. There's something to be said about, you know, a low budget, so bad it's good movie, like a Neil Breen thing or something like that. It's got a charm to it. But I always do enjoy a big, colossal failure like this a little more, where it's like they are swinging for the fences, you know, to use a phrase that I like to say, they are taking a big swing. And sometimes when you take a big swing, it is a home run. But sometimes when you take a big swing, you strike out in a absolutely spectacular way. And that's what I think they did here. And yeah, just like rewatching it this time, I really took a note of like, how fucking good all of the effects were, all the weird ideas. You know, you mentioned that, you know, all the like the bounding stuff like that. I mean, the scenarios would be ridiculous. It's like you put the car in eco mode and now you can go over the cracking cliff and the bad guys that are chasing you smash into the thing. That's dumb as hell, but fuck, I had fun watching it and it looked dope.
Yes. Also, again, AI, what the fuck? No moonroof joke? It was right there. Again, it's this easy stuff that like you need a human screenwriter to get. You do AI to get your scripts, people. This is the crap you get. You miss these easy opportunities. I kept waiting for them to punch the top of the Lexus out and for somebody to go, moonroof. Never. Dude, and also, I have to say, because I'm going to keep harping on this. Yes, the Lexus part sucks. That car chase is amazing for many reasons. Can I tell you why I love the car chase? I'm like, please, obsessed with the car chase. Here's why that car chase is awesome. Because in the middle of this, if you think about it in a real world, you know, if you try to ground your view for a moment, if this truly was happening and society was breaking down, it's a great fucking concept to have people just out pretending like now real life, the rules are gone. They're just treating real life like it's Grand Theft Auto. And they're going to take it up a notch. They're not just going to steal cars or rob things. They're going after oxygen. That's a great stupid thing. Like in that writer's room, applaud that person. That's a great stupid notch in the belt right there, because that's exactly what would happen. And you have this great bit where, you know, the family led by Michael Pena is, you know, they have the oxygen that they've borrowed from the fire department. They're trying to get away. And then you have the robbers, right, who are following them to boost the oxygen. We get a fucking gunfight in the car. I loved the insanity of it, but then to raise the bar, all right, on a visual level, on a sheer scale, we get the bit where the moon is crossing, so now it's messing with gravity, now things are blowing up, exploding, so you've got tankers flying into the scene as a car chase is happening, kind of like, it's not just watching the destruction, kind of like, okay, Roland Emmerich puts the pieces, and now we watch the Chrysler Building explode. It's like, no. We're in a car chase experiencing this Roland Emmerich thing while this moon thing is happening, and there's a gunfight, and it's a Lexus commercial because we need the money. And it's just so bananas to me. And that's when the movie woke up, where I was like, what a movie. This is great. All I'm missing is like a giant beer, a bunch of pretzels. Fuck it. You know, let's get in here. Let everybody smoke out the room. Let's have an amazing time with this sequence, because I was just floored by the audacity of that sequence.
Yeah, definitely. And I think nothing's more frustrating when you see a movie that has a really cool concept that's really interesting that is just not ever realized, you know. And one people like to bring up is like the Purge, you know, the first Purge, not the first Purge, but like the original Purge movie to come out, and how that movie got dinged for like, oh yeah, like there's this whole idea of a purge, but it's just kind of a typical home invasion movie. And obviously people heard that criticism, and all the rest of the Purges really leaned into that concept. But they didn't need a first Purge movie to get wrong. They were like, this movie is called Moonfall. The fucking moon is going to fall. Like, exactly what it says on the tin, you are fucking getting. Have you played Majora's Mask? Because that shit is happening now again in this movie.
First off, what a pull. I love that you have I love that you had a Majora's Mask toss in there. That is great.
I needed to work it in somehow.
Thank you. And you know what? All the Zelda fans are happy about that. So we appreciate you, Derek. You're doing the good work. Yes, absolutely. You're right. If it says it on the poster, the moon had better fall, and boy, oh boy, does it. And it all the ideas surrounding that, even just besides the megastructure, just the destruction on Earth and the way that's dealt with, I think is aces. It is so stupid, it's aces. And then you get to the real, I mean, it wants to be Kubrick 2001 so bad, even down to like, now here is a projection of a person you know talking to you from your past. Like,
yeah,
it was just funny because recently I won't go off on a tangent here about The Abyss, but I just rewatched The Abyss for my show. And it's funny because The Abyss basically does this exact ending. We've got a guy flying into the middle of an alien craft. He sort of stops in this like plane background. The alien shows up and it's like, here, I'm going to show you a screen, everything that's happening, and we're going to project some things to you so that we can quickly go over our history and what's happening. And that is exactly what happened here. And I had to laugh to myself because I was like, wow, we really have locked on to this trope. This is definitely a trope. It's not a trope you think of right away, but rubber stamp this trope because it's here. If your guy goes into a spaceship in your movie, the alien has got to give him a glorified PowerPoint presentation. How he delivers that information is up to him, up to you, the filmmaker. Here it was begging for the return of Donald Sutherland. That would have been so sweet as a Connor fan, like smart. But instead we get both crappy sons, versions of Patrick Wilson's son. The little one is bad. I try not to rag on kid actors, but that kid was terrible. The older kid is fine, but that kid actor is rough stuff at first.
Yeah.
But it's cool. Like the That is one thing that I think the AI did successfully on its script was the way the backstory of the moon as a megastructure, I thought was actually very cool.
Yeah, no, I totally agree. That when they have that whole, they just kind of stop the movie to be like, here's the backstory. And it, like, there was this whole history in the planet, and you know, the moon was what seeded the Earth with like fucking Prometheus DNA or whatever. And you know what it reminded me a lot, talking about how this is a trope? It really, like, beat for beat felt a lot like, did you ever watch Mission to Mars?
Yes.
That Disney movie. Okay.
Yes, Brian De Palma.
Yes. Which is a movie that, like, I liked it a lot as a kid. I haven't revisited it as an adult, so it just kind of lives in my memory as being good. I don't know how, like, accurate that is, but the end where it's like Gary Sinise goes up to Mars and it's like he finds out there's this whole mystery there and what's going on, and it's like, oh, he goes to the face and there's this big structure inside, and then these aliens tell them, like, actually, the Earth came from here. This thing that's really, you know, another thing in the solar system that's pretty close to Earth, and they seeded it, and that's where humanity and life on Earth came from, is actually from this other thing. And I was like, this is, like very similar to this movie that, like, everyone kind of hates and forgot about. So, like, I was really drawing those comparisons.
Yes, absolutely. Also, shout out to my fellow Disney heads. Disney World Mission Space is Mission to Mars the Ride.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, I think there are certain, definitely Emmerich loves this idea, this thread that aliens basically are responsible for humanity, that they planted the seed for humanity,
right,
and basically created, like, you can go back all the way to Stargate, the thing that inducted me into my Roland Emmerich movies. Again, treats it like, oh yeah, aliens populated the universe, and that's kind of how that explains the pyramids and crop circles and why, you know, these humans look like this and these humans are over here on this other planet that's basically a carbon copy of Earth. I do see that. Emmerich loves that. So it was kind of funny to see him in a way return to his roots. I'm not sure if he injected that in there or if the AI did. I refuse to believe this movie was written by actual people. If the AI injected it in there, because it's funny, it's a running thing through his movies, and not even in like a conspiratorial way, not even in his like anonymous, the Patriot kind of way. Like, no, he clearly likes this idea. And again, that's why it would have been so perfect to have Donald Sutherland in delivering that information. Would have been perfect.
Yeah, and I honestly wonder, like, is he somebody who actually believes in conspiracy theories, or is he someone like me who, like, I hate people who believe in conspiracy theories. I think they're all insane and garbage and stuff like that. But I'm also super fascinated by them and think that they make for very interesting, compelling films. So I'm just like, how much of his stuff does he believe? Because I'm like, I've heard him say some stuff about, like, you know, we brought up Anonymous, like, he thinks that this Shakespeare conspiracy, because, like, I think Anonymous is actually fun and interesting, but I'm like, this is not history. This is, like, a fun historical fiction. But I, like, he maybe believes that. So I'm like, how much does he believe about the moon?
Like, okay. All right. I think, though, you're saying it's interesting, and I agree with you. It's interesting in that coffee shop conversation kind of way, where, like, all right, neither of us believe this because we're normal and sane people, but isn't this fun to imagine what if Shakespeare wasn't really Shakespeare and another guy had written all his plays? Okay. I think Roland Emmerich is twofold. I think he does, a part of him does believe it, but I think he also likes that archetype because it has also followed him in his career. Have you seen 2012?
I have, yeah.
Okay, Woody Harrelson is basically, he's kind of a combination of the Game of Thrones guy in this movie and almost a little bit Donald Sutherland in this movie as well, where he's basically just like a conspiracy nut who's been tracking the Mayans. And that one was all about, I forgot what it was. It was like the ice exploding and all the little stuff coming down the debris. But it's the same guy. It's a guy with a conspiracy nut with a blog. Like, I think Emmerich has a soft spot for that crankpot character and likes to put him in, and then uses that character as a vessel for, like, I can't say this. I think he's like a German. I can't say this at my dinner party, but I will use Woody Harrelson to say it for me. And then no one will accuse me then, right? So I think that's what's going on.
Okay, and it's because, you bring up an interesting point, because it's never the main character. It's always like a side guy who brings it to the main character. It's always like Woody Harrelson presented it to John Cusack, or Sam from Game of Thrones bringing it to Patrick Wilson. So, I think that is kind of a fascinating wrinkle And I just wanted to circle back to something we brought up. You brought up way a while back, but I thought it was really a good point because I also had it in my notes, and that's about Patrick Wilson and how, yeah, I don't know if it's his agent or if he's just really bad at selecting things. And that's not to say he's not in good stuff, because he is in good movies, but all of the most popular, famous Patrick Wilson roles are in The Worst Thing. And I'm like, is he in on it? It's hard to tell. Like, it's really difficult because, yeah, it's like this, or it's like a bunch of like horror just schlock that he's apparently like now he's like it's two different horror series, one of which he's gone on to direct now. And I know some people like those movies, but definitely not my cup of tea. Or like, you know, he's eating fucking cockroaches in the Aquaman sequel.
God, yeah, that's
what I, yeah. Jeez, what is going on with Patrick Wilson, man?
I know he deserves better because he's actually a great leading man, I think, and I've seen him in some good stuff. I think, you know, good is a relative term, but like, I think Watchmen, he does amazing work. Mm-hmm. But yeah, I think he is one of these actors who is in love with the idea of what if. He doesn't think beyond the surface. So he gets a packet on his desk from his agent that says, Roland Emmerich, disaster movie, you're the star. And he's like, oh, that sounds amazing. And he accepts without reading, thinking about it, walking it through. I think he's in love with the sticker on the car. And that's what he buys. And then he's too committed. He signed the deal. He can't walk away now. And that's how you get shit. Because, like, I think sometimes that works for him, right? He sees the sticker. He's like, oh, Aquaman, James Wan, the DC movie. This is going to be huge. And then, whoops, right? It just, like, keeps happening to him. He lucked out into that Conjuring franchise. Those movies, I think, also have also kind of, like, it's been diminishing returns. Mm-hmm. I like the Insidious movies more than most. But, yeah, even that, it's, like, it's he needs, you know what he needs? He needs like a, and I'm not saying he can fulfill the same type of roles, but he needs like a Sam Rockwell path. Mm. Okay, get him with Martin McDonagh. Get him with somebody who can get some weird performances where it's okay to be weird, where he can kind of get away from his looks. Just let him be an actor, because then I think he would actually get onto something. But yeah, I think this guy is just tricked. He's tricked. It's an easy deception to fall for. If I was at a cocktail party and Roland Emmerich came up to me and he was like, I'm going to make another movie, you're going to be, I'd be like, this is going to be amazing. This can change my life. And then I get there and it's fucking Moonfall. You know what I mean?
Right. But the thing is, too, he's like always really good in bad movies. Like, yeah. It's one of the things is like, I don't know if he understands the assignment or he just has the right vibes. But like, to once again, you know, obviously in this, I think he's phenomenal. He's kind of like wisecracking and stuff like that. But like even in Aquaman 2, which is like a pretty, for the most part, irredeemable movie, he is just having so much fun. Like whenever it's that meme. It's like whenever Patrick Wilson is on screen, people should be asking, where is Patrick Wilson? Like he just brings so much to that film. And like Jason Momoa, like I like Jason Momoa, but he's really just trying to be Chris Hemsworth in that movie. And he's funny in like a casual like my man way, but when he's just trying to do straight up comedy, I don't think it works in the way that like Patrick Wilson is just like kind of playing the straight man, like the very serious, like, yes, I'm Ortman. It's like real, it's way funnier than anything anyone else is in that movie when they're trying to be funny. And I'd say similar vibes in this one too. And then to just kind of continue on that, one thing that I noticed was, you know, his interaction with, and I'm going to keep calling him Sam from Game of Thrones, that did that interaction feel weird to you? Because it felt like they should have really, like, maybe it speaks to what you're talking about earlier, where like the first 45 seemed to lag, where they're like opposed like for a while, where he's like this crazy conspiracy guy. And like, why? You saw this thing. You're like this cloud. You're discredited for basically this conspiracy that everyone's trying to cover up. You see someone who's like, there's a conspiracy. There's this thing going on with the moon. Just like screenwriting trick, just make him be like, huh, there's somebody else. Like this guy's kind of a crackpot, but maybe he can explain why this whole thing happened to me. That seems like a shortcut they should have taken. You know, what do you think?
Absolutely. I think you're absolutely right. It's weird. Again, it's like they think that, oh, okay, because he has this kind of tete-a-tete interplay with Halle Berry, he should also have that with Sam from Game of Thrones, because that's how the audience reads mismatched buddy duo, right? That, again, like an AI computer was like, this is what buddy comedy is. They are mismatched. Ha ha ha. He has IBS. He is handsome. that's what it thinks. Like, dude, I felt so bad for Sam from Game of Thrones when his character is basically just like demeaned to having to say like, I have anxiety, I have IBS, because like, I was like, why is this character's life doesn't suck enough? We have to also give him all of these conditions. Like, he lives alone, mother in a nursing home, the cat's the only friend, been denied entry into his field of study, everybody thinks he's a fucking crank. Nope, that's not enough. We also now have to give him it can't just be any condition, he's got to have IBS, because that's funny. They treat it like a joke in the movie. It's just kind of sad, because again, that's what the AI thinks reads as a joke, and then they have to be contentious because that's what it thinks it reads as budding unlikely friends come together, because it's so weird. Okay, to highlight what you're talking about, they have their tete-a-tete, but then they're together kind of like once the tidal wave hits, and they're even sharing a hotel room, which why are they wasting time sleeping? That made no sense. Also, how did the government find them? That also made no sense. But then when NASA picks them up, the first thing he starts doing before Halle Berry walks in the room, keep in mind, now we've seen them become friendly, is just tear him down. It's so weird, because then later on, we're supposed to believe they're best buddies. Like, when he decides to sacrifice himself, Patrick Wilson is like in tears. Like, it's supposed to be like fucking Kirk and Spock at the end of Wrath of Khan. And I didn't feel that at all. I was like, I don't buy this for 1 second. Did you?
No, I did not. It's definitely like a plot contrivance that the AI writer had to put in to get them to this point. And there are quite a lot of those. One that really, was not as fun for me and kind of took me out of the movie a little bit is when they're like, this engine has failed. Well, I guess we must immediately send everyone home. Don't take 5 minutes to think about this. Everyone's gone. Oh, well, we've just thought of a solution that we could have thought of when everyone's here, but we needed a way to get just three characters onto the space shuttle with no other team or anything like that. And that was just like the laziest way to do it.
100%. Also, and then it doubles down on the laziness, because it's like, oh, the sort of AI that's up there protecting the moon megastructure senses technology. So we have to go in the old school space suits that don't have any tech or wiring or computer systems in them. Our shuttle's going to fly totally blind, no tech, so that we can go in under the radar. Okay, first off, fuck that shit. Peter Berg did that exact same thing in the Battleship movie. It's literally the exact same thing. It's like, here come the aliens. What is Rihanna and the Navy going to do? We got to go back to the old way we used to do shit before computers. So we're using charts and pings and stuff.
Right.
They stole it. And again, this movie doesn't want to think beyond that. The movie succeeds when it does think beyond that. Again, the ridiculousness of a car chase during a moonfall. The ridiculousness of the moon being this megastructure. That's cool. Stuff we've never seen before. But like that kind of shit, to be like, now they're going to go the old school astronaut suits. It felt so tired. I know nobody saw Battleship. That's what they were counting on. They were counting on two things. They were counting on nobody having seen Battleship and nobody having seen Lost World Jurassic Park, because they stole the fucking joke. They stole a joke. They get to the ship, the megastructure, and they lose Patrick Wilson. And they're like, Patrick, or his name is Brian, or Brian Harper. Brian Harper, where are you? And she turns,
yes.
How many Brian Harpers do you think are on here? And I was like, hey, that's from Lost World. You stole it.
Yeah. How many Sarah Hardings do you think are on this island? I totally forgot that. Yes.
You're a fellow Jurassic Park fan. I fucking knew you would appreciate that, because I was like, again, the balls on this AI to decide it was going to steal that joke like we wouldn't notice. We noticed.
We noticed the theft from that. We noticed the theft from Mission to Mars. All these movies that I think nobody has seen. Well, guess what? Me and Matt are cinephiles of some schlock, and we fucking saw it.
That's right. That's right, AI. You can't beat humanity. You can't. John Connor warned us about you. You can't fuck with us. We know, man. We're already ahead of you.
You think you can destroy us with the moon? Well, it's not going to be that easy, because we have Halle Berry and Patrick Wilson.
That's right. That's right. God damn it. We're here. We're catching the AI.
Yeah.
I also have to say, okay, now I'm going to go back. This is like a love hate, because now I'm going to go back to loving the movie for a moment. Can we talk about how cool it is? I think it's a legitimately, no, I'm not being funny. I think it's a legitimately beautiful sequence when their rover falls through the cavern that's inside the middle of the moon. And it's just like that giant black hole that they're traveling down. And he gets them to fly close to the side of the tunnel. To me, I remember that from the big screen. It was not as cool on my television. I have a nice TV, but it was not as cool. On the big screen, that sequence was phenomenal. And again, that's just like fun visual fireworks from Roland Emmerich. No thanks to the AI on that one.
Yeah, no, because like we said, this movie looks great. It's like a movie that I had a really good time seeing up on the big screen. And it is a little bit sad that not too many people did. This movie does feel like a movie that is stuck in the early aughts in a lot of ways. And that, you know, it is part of this dying genre, but I think that maybe if throughout all this kind of these contrivances and the cliches and, you know, the things that we've been jokingly saying are like written by AI, if it made it try to catch up a little bit, I think that you legitimately could have a movie that is in this genre that could be a hit. You just got to stay with the times a little bit, you know?
100%. And I think that it's not just in concept, right? I think it's an execution too, to kind of update and get with the times, because I think the concept of the moon and it being a megastructure is something novel, something that I think modern audiences have not seen. But I think with the proper execution, it could have been an A24 level, like, ooh, a real brain buster, right? I think about what somebody like Alex Garland would do with that budget. Great. You know, he would really, I mean, I'm sure he would do something extra weird. It would not be palatable for a mass audience. But I do think Roland Emmerich, again, I like to hear satisfaction, you know, to borrow that from Chef, right? If the Stones didn't play Satisfaction, would you be upset? And he's like, yeah. If Roland Emmerich has to play his hits all the time, that's cool. But I would love if he learned some new songs. That would be amazing.
Exactly. You when you see the Killers, you want to hear Mr. Brightside, but you also want to hear the new stuff. You know, you want to hear you want to be the first one to hear the new song, the new album that's going to drop. You got to get a little bit of both.
Absolutely. Don't be the guy at the show that boos when the new songs play. Fuck that person.
Right. Absolutely. Well, we've talked about a lot of the good and the bad and how those are kind of some of the same things sometimes. Is there anything else you wanted to touch on the good or the bad of this movie, or just, you know, in general about this whole thing?
Yeah, I have one more thing that I want to touch on.
Yes, please.
And that is this idea that we need. I hate the idea of like needing to force some kind of like familial memory to make you. It's such an easy shorthand. It's like, and the thing I'm talking about is, again, Michael Pena gets the worst bits in this movie. The bit with his daughter makes no sense. So her oxygen tank is faulty and she's like, I can't breathe. And he's like, oh, okay, no problem. And they trade oxygen tanks and we know he's going to die at this point. But it's such a weird thing that he leaves her with. It's not some memory like, okay, run like we used to run in Little League. It's something weird where he goes, just walk left, right, left, left, right, left. I was like, A, if she walked left, right, left, she would be walking funny. She would not be walking the way that a normal human being walks. But also, he's not a military guy, so that made no sense. The little girl reacts like it's, oh, I guess I don't know how to fucking walk. Like, it's in that moment that I'm like, it calls to something that I'm like, I think this is such a shitty shorthand for trying to emotionally manipulate your audience. It's enough that the little girl's oxygen tank doesn't work. We're human beings. We're fucking scared for her because she's a little girl and we have hearts. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. We don't need the extra step of you applying some fake bullcrap on top. That doesn't even make sense. None of that's hard. It made it weird. It made me not care about the little girl. I was like, just let it be. Anyway, I wanted to touch on that because I thought it was so bizarre. I hated also that Sam from Game of Thrones' cat was named Fuzz Aldrin. Get the fuck out of here. I hated
yeah.
that. I also hated the quick shorthand when Patrick Wilson was in the dumpster digging, trying to find the coordinates that Sam got rid of. And he's been digging, presumably he's like all full of trash, you know, and he's like been digging in the dumpster for hours. And of course, the minute the night security guard shows up, he's like, are you looking for these? And he points at the papers that are right in front of the dump. It's not like he had to dig. So Patrick Wilson's character would have had to have stepped over those, gone into the dumpster to just bathe in trash and not see them. It was that kind of stuff where I was like, I can't believe this is the same guy who gave us, I'm back, you fuckers, right? Like, and gave us President Whitmore, you know, that Independence Day speech. And, Halle Berry wanted to have that speech so bad when she was telling people to go home. And I was like, it's not working. I'm sorry. Yeah. That's all I got. That's all I got. I hope in the future that Roland Emmerich, because I'm a sucker for a disaster movie, but I don't think he needs to reinvent the wheel and don't play your hits. In fact, if I was Roland Emmerich's agent or like the little angel on his shoulder, I would say, remake something that you don't have anything to do with. We need a Towering Inferno remake. You could be the guy. Just saying. Do that. Bring us something cool.
Yeah, and I think that, you know, I don't know that Roland Emmerich is ever going to make a movie like this again. You know, like the studios obviously kind of stopped giving him money before this. This one he had to get independently funded after the results of this movie. Doesn't look like that will happen again. So he might be in director jail a little bit, but I don't think that means he's never going to make anything again, because he does clearly have other things that disaster movie he makes. We talked about Anonymous a lot. He also has, of course, you know, Roland Emmerich is a gay man and he made Stonewall. You know, that's a movie that is obviously nothing like this. And I would love to see some more of his one for me's, you know, some things that he is passionate about, some stuff like that. And I think that, you know, that might be the next Roland Emmerich we would get, is something that is a lot more personal with a much more scaled down budget, a much more personal and just, you know, films that's driven by more acting than effects, with a presumably much stronger script, and something that, unlike this one, doesn't end with a shameless sequel pitch that will obviously never happen.
That will never in a million years happen. What was the point? Don't even do it. Don't waste anyone's time. You've put Sam from Game of Thrones through enough. You're going to make him do this bullshit scene. It doesn't go anywhere.
Right.
Let this man go home. He doesn't want to do this anymore.
Well, Matt, thank you. Thank you so much. Before I let you go, before I let you do your final pitch or anything, I wanted to ask you, because, you know, we talked about your schlock credentials, what's one of your favorite schlocky movies? And it might be So Bad It's Good, or it might just be something that's underrated. Give us some schlock. Oh. And it doesn't have to be like the best of anything, but, and you know, I know I'm putting you on the spot, but I always try to do this to my guests, give them something good to pitch here at the end.
Not at all. I'm going to cheat and look at my letterbox. I will tell you, if you want some good space schlock, space themed schlock, you can't go wrong with The Incredible Melting Man. I actually think it's on one of the streamers, Tubi or Amazon Prime Video right now. You can watch free with ads. Really fun 70s space monster movie. I won't go into more detail. If it sounds like it's up your alley, you will like it. You will know right away if you want to watch that movie from the poster, because it is grotesque. I do want to call out, wait, I have my letterboxed here. I also do want to call out, we're going to go for schlock, The Vagrant. This is a movie that doesn't take place in space. It takes place in the real world, starring a very young Bill Paxton. Rest in peace, Bill Paxton. Simple premise. I'm going to set this up for you. Bill Paxton wants to buy a starter home. He shows up. He starts remodeling the home, gussying it up. A vagrant lives there and doesn't want to leave. This turns into one of the most bizarre horror comedies of the 90s you've never seen. It feels like a Lost Tales from the Crypt episode. Awesome, awesome movie. That one is on Tubi as well. But I would call it schlock, because it is definitely a whole lot of schlock. Yeah, I really think you can't go wrong with either one of those movies. And also, let's go for a little highbrow schlock. Schlock, but highbrow. We want to talk about sci-fi. Go for Silent Running. You want to go to space? Go to space with Bruce Stern and Silent Running. I think you will get some good old-fashioned space schlock out of that one, too.
Yeah, I mean, I'm always a fan of schlock, especially highbrow schlock. And, you know, I'll throw out one, and it's not like a deep cut or anything, but one of my favorite 80s schlock movies is The Running Man. I fucking love The Running Man.
Great movie. Now, Plane Zero. One of the best jokes ever.
Right? Oh, God, it's so good. And, like, Arnold is just pitch perfect in that one.
He's great. Any 80s Arnold is amazing. To this day, my co-host and I, Mark, I've known the guy over 20 years. We still quote Commando to each other, where he goes, remember when I promised to kill you last? I lied. And he drops the guy. fucking thing of beauty. One of the best moments ever in cinema, man. So awesome.
Yep. Always, Arnold always has understood the assignment. And just like Matt, you have always understood the assignment. So thank you once again for coming on and shooting the shit with me about this fucking great movie that is terrible, but it's also great. Where can people hear the Matt and Mark Movie Show? What do you want to let people know before you go?
Hey, thank you for that, Derek. Always a pleasure to be here talking shop, talking film with you. Anytime. I'm down, buddy. The Matt and Mark Movie Show, do catch us. We're available on all the big podcast platforms. On social, it's at the Matt and Mark Movie Show. You can catch us on TikTok, Instagram. We've got some fun retro reviews up right now. St. Paddy's Day just passed, and guess what? We did the obvious thing, and we reviewed the very first Leprechaun with an Englishman. We should have gotten an Irishman, but we do talk about that. We discuss whether or not Irish people actually like that movie or whether they're offended by it. It was pretty cool. We've also done stuff like Dr. Giggles has been great. And it's great. We returned to the cinema recently, too, to review the new Blumhouse Imaginary. So we've got some fun episodes. And this week, we're returning to the cinema for Ghostbusters Frozen Empire. Can't wait. Very excited to see if it can live up to the hype I think we all have in our minds. I doubt it. But yeah, come join us. It's just kind of some buddies talking about some schlocky movies, giving them crap. And occasionally we have like some guests who know their stuff, like Derek here, who's on our brings our show up a level when he appears.
I don't know about that, but I always have a blast whenever I come on and whenever I listen to it as well. Very excited to hear you guys' take on Ghostbusters, yeah, which would definitely be out by the time this episode drops, so everybody go and listen to that. Once you're done listening to that, if you know you're here for the first time because you're a fan of Matt's, check out the rest of the episodes of Underrated. If you want to subscribe, rate us 5 stars, that would be awesome. If you want to follow us on social media, it's Underrated Movie Podcast on all the social media apps, on all the podcast platforms, YouTube, Spotify, Apple, wherever podcasts are. I guess Google Podcasts is going away now. Also, of course, have a Patreon, patreon.com/underratedmoviepodcast. Do 2 bonus podcasts there. One is released sporadically on the Marvel Cinematic Universe. That's available for all patrons. It's called Infinity Stones and Dragon Bones, a podcast Matt has also been on. And then, of course, also the Underdogs podcast, where I talk about underrated sports films. Another podcast. Matt, I'm, you know, speaking of Infinity Stones, Matt, I'm like collecting Matt, like in a stone for each of my podcasts. I've got to have an appearance on everything. So,
man, I love it. Infinity Stones and Dragon Bones, the best podcast name. I stand by that. That's your platform if you ever run for office, that you came up with that name.
Thank you. I will take that to the bank. But yeah, if you want to, you know, listen, that's as little as $1 a month. But, you know, if you can't donate or if you just, you know, just don't feel like it, you know, just drop that 5-star review. That really helps us a lot. It's a free way to do it. And yeah, just keep listening. Hopefully you guys hear me next time. Once again, thank you, Matt, for being on, and I'll catch everyone on the next episode of Underrated.